Testing, 1, 2, 3?
Mm-hmm.
Just talk to me a minute. Okay. So I want to test it.
1, 2, 3, 4. You ask the questions and I'll go.
Okay, give me your name and what unit you were with, and then tell me a little bit about your early background, where you were brought up, what your family did, and then how you happened to come and serve it.
My name is Nehemiah Atkinson. I came from New Orleans, Louisiana. My parent, the bishop, and C.C. Atkinson. My mother's name was Josephine. We came from the state of Mississippi into the state of Louisiana. Educated in the school system, New Orleans, Louisiana. And this is where the Army picked me up. The Army picked me up and carried me into the service.
And what were your folks doing for a living?
My father was a minister. My mother was a housewife. She had the job of raising 10 children. There are 10 of us in family. 9 of us are still alive.
And what church did your father, was he a minister for?
He was minister of Triumphant Church of the Kingdom of God in Christ. He rose from a lay minister to be bishop of the 3rd District. The 3rd District consists of the state of Mississippi, Louisiana, Texas, and Oklahoma. At one time, he was bishop of the 1st District, but they transferred him back to the 1st District by a popular demand.
And did you enlist in the service, or did they come and get you?
Uncle sent me my invitation and told me he wanted me. I really said I didn't know anybody named Uncle. But then he made the voice that I am Uncle Sam and I want you. And I was available to go. I wasn't married, 22 years old, and they were taking that age bracket. They put me in 1A.
How far had you gone through school when you went in service?
I was in the 2nd year of college.
In which college?
And it was Louisiana Normal.
Okay. And then which branch did you end up in? And just tell me where you mustered and where you went.
Inducted into the armed services, going to camp. Boy Guard in Alexandria, Louisiana, from Camp Boy Guard to Camp Shelby, Mississippi, from Camp Shelby to Camp Wheeler, Georgia, that's Macon, Georgia. I was trained in the infantry in Macon, Georgia. When the Japanese struck Pearl Harbor on the 8th of December, on a Sunday morning, I was winding up my 16 weeks of training in Macon, Georgia. After having completed the service at Macon, Georgia, they transferred my unit down to Camp Claiborne in the Engineers. We were in the Engineers a short time, then they transferred my unit again to Fort Lewis, Washington, Seattle, Washington. From Seattle, Washington to Valdez, Alaska.
Came up by boat then?
Came up by boat. Right by Ketchikan, Alaska into Valdez, Alaska.
And you had Special Corps of Engineering training. You ended up in the medical section, did you?
I had engineering training, but they needed medicals. And they sent me to school to be a medical technician. They also sent me to an administrative school. All this took place while we were in Alaska. Had to be a good administrator, and I had to be a good medical technician. After having stayed in Alaska those months to build the Alcan Highway, which was a great experience, a great education, it came time for us to leave Alaska. We came from Alaska to Camp Sutton, North Carolina, That's just outside of Charlotte, North Carolina.
When did you come out of Alaska? You tell me when you arrived there, sort of spring of 1942?
About 1944 when we came out of there. 43, I said 1943 when
did
we
Did you
came
come
out.
Right off the Alaska Highway, or did you go with some of those troops down to the Aleutians?
I didn't go with the troops to Illusion. We came from Alaska to Camp Sutton, North Carolina. We were there about 5 months. Then Uncle sent us to Camp Stoneman in San Francisco, California, preparing us to go to the South Seas. That's to New Guinea.
You went to the South Seas?
We went to the South Seas. We went from San Francisco, right by Alcatraz. Then, believe it or not, we got stuck on the sand barge. We were stuck on the sand barge for about a half a day before we could get pumped off the sand. Finally, we were pumped off. We went on out in the Atlantic Ocean, passing right through the Kara Sea, right where the USS Lexington went down from the Japanese seven-day battle. Our first land of sight was Buna, New Guinea. It was too hot with the Japanese to land, so we had to pull up and move into another area.
And how long did you stay in the South Seas? You saw active fire there, I would suppose.
I didn't see actual fire. We were there my unit was there to build airstrips, build roadways, and prepare in case the enemy struck. We were a short ways away on a very clear day. We could see the United States 5th Army Bomber Squad. Bum Hollandia. That was across the Bismarck Sea, but we didn't get into the actual fighting.
And what islands did you work on?
We worked on Ley, L-A-E. We worked on Finch Haven. We worked on Shangri-La. And we shipped out of we were just off Bougainville, New Guinea.
And when you came out of that area, you mustered out of service right after the war ended? Or?
I got out of service on points. Everybody in that area got out on high points, with the exception of me. You had to have 85 points. I had 84. So finally, they got down to me. I had an MOS that was in the medicals that tied me up because I was in medical. They need medics in the area at that time. They tied me up until they got down to a number that reached me. That was 84.
So somebody in here all by themselves.
After having gotten down to my number, we were shipped out from New Guinea to Honolulu. From Honolulu, we came to St. Pedro. That's up just outside of Los Angeles. And from St. Pedro to Los Angeles, we were stationed at Port Anza. It's about 20 miles out of Los Angeles. And from Los Angeles, they shipped us down to Camp Fannin, Texas. That's where I was discharged December 1945, around Christmas time.
And what kind of job did you get when you got out of service?
I didn't get a job when I got out of service. I went to school in offset printing. Offset printing was a new field. I did offset printing for the local YMCA. And did a good job at it. After having done offset, then I thought that it would be a good idea to play tennis. So I organized a tennis club, City of New Orleans, with 8 men to teach kids how to play tennis. That's 1946. I still work with the YMCA and taught tennis to many kids. I went to many schools, talking, lecturing on tennis, and I got many kids involved in tennis. We were still segregated then. The school system was segregated, but I made the black schools, and when a kid came into our program, he or she, the 8 of us who built the club into about 35 professional men, we were able to give scholarships to these guys, boys and girls, when they became of age. And I still do that now. I have a foundation called Nehemiah Askerson Scholarship Foundation. I send both kids to school, boys and girls, black and white. We give them $1,000 scholarship to begin with, and they must stick with tennis. And we have been very successful. We are now in our 14th year of doing this. I had done it before, but we had no money. But one young man whom I sent to Grambling State University, he found out that I had done something for him. Then he decided to do something for me. 14 years ago, he organized the Nehemiah Atkinson Scholarship Foundation.
And you've played some of the great tennis players yourself, haven't you?
Yes, I play, and I still play. I play some of the great tennis players, and I play all over the country. Frankly, this time of the year, I'm usually at Fort Myers, Florida, Park Meadow. They called me last Monday and asked me if I was coming. We were looking for you. I just couldn't go because this event had priority over going to the tournament. My doubles partner, Dr. Paul DeCamp, still insists that I must go and play, but this is more important. I played Bobby Riggs twice. I played him indoors, San Francisco, Fifth Street Tennis Club downtown. I played Gordon Malloy. I played Vic Satius. I played against Vic Satius, and I played with Vic Satius. And the only one who is not active today is Bobby Riggs. Bobby Riggs is sick. But Vic Satius go on tours to give lectures. And we do have a great time in playing tennis. Last year I played down to the last 4 tennis players in a national 70-year-old championship out of 138 draw. And I have won everything that a tennis player could win in tennis, being a member of the Hall of Fame. I have Robert Kennedy's, I spent a week with the Kennedy's. I have Robert Kennedy's Memorial Award, a very prestigious thing. Right now, it must be worth about $18,000. I have the Special Olympic Hall of Fame. I have the Touchstone Memorial Award. Last year, I was the chairman of the Annie Sugar Bowl Classic held in New Orleans.
I want to go back to your Alcan experience a little bit. I'm particularly interested because you're the only person I've met who really knew or was in touch with the man who froze to death out there with the unit. Could you explain what happened in that case? And
yes.
And see, which unit were you with? Which unit of the Corps of Engineers?
I was with the 97th GS General Service Regiment,
okay.
Medical Detachment. I was a sergeant in charge of 37 men who spread it out from company to company. I stayed in the headquarters. What happened with the soldier who froze to death? They had gone out for supplies in the early evening on the island at Valdez on the Alcan Highway. They went out to pick up diesel fuel and gas.
They'd gone to Valdez?
No, they were out on the near Valdez.
Okay.
Near Valdez.
You were based at Valdez at the time?
We were based at about 7 miles, what they call 7 mile post from Valdez. It was a very bad day, and they went out to get diesel fuel and gas. On their way back toward the camp, the truck froze up on them, Studebaker truck. That's what we used in that area. The truck froze up on them. They couldn't get it started. And I remember the white officer was named Lieutenant H-A-R-T, I believe is the right pronunciation, right spelling of his name. He was from Shreveport, Louisiana. I don't remember the frozen soldier's name, even though I had to thaw him out. But I showed you the pictures of the grave. After this truck stalled, they got out of the truck. Lieutenant Hart grabbed the soldier by the hand to pull him along to keep him going. It got so that he couldn't pull him any longer. He said it is better that one of us lose our lives than the both. So he had to let the soldier go. He came into the company area with frozen hand, frozen feet, frozen arm. He was just about dead. But we were able to thaw him out well. And 2 days later, we went to look for the soldier. The first day we couldn't find him. The second day we couldn't find him. The third day we found him and brought him to the medical detachment dispensary just out of Valdez and began thawing him out for the embalmer. He was embalmed and buried at Ladfield, Fairbanks, Alaska.
Do you know about how far out they were when they broke down, how many miles the lieutenant had to walk?
About eight, separate, between 8 and 10 miles.
And was it a storm? Was it super cold, or was it just...
It was super cold, and they hit the snowstorm. What happened, because us not to find him, is that whistling wind came up, and that banked that snow up on him. That gave us a job to find him.
Did you have much problem with frostbite? Did you lose any other people in your group?
We didn't lose any other people. We had the problem of frozen nose, frozen cheek, frozen ear, frozen fingers. But losing fingers and hand, we didn't have that problem.
I've got a couple of other questions, so let's find out what time. I was wondering about injuries in your unit, and you said there were other frostbites and certain, but nothing really severe?
Not serious as frostbitten nose or fingers, something like that.
And where did your unit travel during the period you were working on the Alaska Highway?
Pardon?
Where did your group go? You started at Valdez and then you worked your way?
Our unit worked from Valdez up to Fairbanks. And after they had gotten to Fairbanks, well, they met the other engineers at Edmonton, Canada.
And did you get down on the Alaska Highway itself?
Did I?
Yes.
Oh, yes, yep. Very definitely. I was on it during this time of the year when I'd come in from Whitehorse. I'd come down at Will Rogers Air Force Base, then we'd drive down to my unit on the Alcan Highway.
And where was your unit stationed on the Alcan?
We were stationed at Big Delta, Alaska, and all along the Alkane Highway, we were stationed whenever the unit needed. The headquarters usually stayed stationary, but the other units had to had to move all the time.
Some of the men who were stationed at Big Delta spent the winter in tents or in a drafty old building that was actually built during World War I, and the warmth of the Air Force base up there was denied them. I mean, they weren't allowed to go on it. I wondered if you had any experience with how the housing went there. Okay, what about housing conditions of the people you saw in Delta? Were they adequately housed? Or?
The Indians live in their regular home. The Eskimos, they had their regular shelters.
But what about the troops at
the
Delta?
The troops had, we lived in a hut. We had huts. We had, was that canvas tops and wood frame around when the winter came. We had to have that because we couldn't sleep on the ground in tents during the cold months of the year. It was just too cold. When you think about 72 degrees below zero, man couldn't survive out there like that.
I think it's amazing that as many survived as did.
Very definite.
What do you attribute that to? Was it your duty, or who actually got the men briefed on what to do and how to take care of themselves?
We had material, knowing that Alaska was cold, and U.S. prepared us with a lot of heavy clothing, like men long unders, unions. You had top and bottom. They were very thick. You had fur-lined boots, you had fur-lined gloves, and you had that regular Army OD material to wear, as well as the overcoats. You had parkas for those who worked out of doors. You had sleeping bags to sleep in that zipped up to here. And in the morning when you wake up, you had a sheet of ice right here from the overnight. You might ask, what did we use for fuel? Well, we used alcohol trees. We had to go out in this snowbound area and cut down alcohol trees and supply each tent with wood. Each company did that, and we burnt wood in 55-gallon drums. Those 55-gallon drums that we had fuel in, we'd cut a top out, put pipes in there. Uncle supplied us with pipes, and that run out to your hut. And we put about a 3-foot chunk of wood down in there, fill it up. That'll last you until way in the night. That's how we kept warm.
How was morale? You got to travel and see a lot of different groups.
The morale was good. We were young, and we didn't know anything about being having a low morale during the spring time of the year. We were able to play ball, and that kept us pretty happy. And those who played touch football, I played baseball and softball, and it kept everybody pretty well happy.
You had some recreation facilities then?
We had a recreation department. The government supplied us with all recreational equipment, and we had one man in charge of all recreation. And we had regular leagues when we had time to play baseball, softball.
This was some of the people who went in didn't have much chance at education. You had quite a bit. Some of the people had some real problems that I've talked about with discrimination. What about your own case? Did you see much discrimination, or was it fairly even?
Well, as I've said before, and I say all the time, I have never had problems in no form or fashion. My father was a minister. We were used to going. He was used to seeing that his children were very well versed. In fact, my father's church in New Orleans was half white and half black. So we had no problem. I had eaten before integration. I had eaten and slept in many white homes, just like white had slept in my home, because my father was a big minister. There were fellows there who was on a low ebb, but they were able to be good manual trained soldiers. And I wasn't the kind who went to town when we were in the vicinity of going to town. I stayed around the company area reading and writing for some of the soldiers who couldn't read and write.
Were they embarrassed about not being able to read and write? Did they come to you quietly, or?
I don't know how they felt. I used to write all the time. They saw my handwriting and they asked me, "Oh, Sergeant, I'd like you to write a letter for me." Now, there were white who were the same way, and I didn't know that until they came to me, who couldn't read and write. Some of them had to make an X, and somebody had to sign behind that X. But, you know, I didn't belittle the guy. I thought that, hey, I didn't know there were people who couldn't read and write until I got in the Army.
And did they have any kind of training program with your group to train people who wanted to learn and read and write?
Well, they had regular schools. If you were short on something, they had regular school sessions to equip you with how to spell this, how to write that, and get yourself out front. And you had regular guides to go by.
Walter Parsons has the information on a court martial of some black men. Do you remember any incidents like that, or any other people in those units?
The court martial, now the captain told me about that. I didn't know about that. That was after my unit had left. But these guys was transferred from my unit to White Horse, Canada. I didn't know about that. The court martials, I don't think I recall any court martials at all in my unit. At Mutiny Group, I wasn't involved in that, and my fellows whom I knew in my unit were not involved in.
The day records show very little problems with anybody going AWOL or anything like that. So I know there were occasional incidents, but probably less than in most units.
Yes. Sure.
Everybody was working too hard. What kind of shifts were people working? What kind of working hours did people have?
They had regular working hours. You worked from early morning to late nights. You worked sometime 20 hours. You have those long days. The cookie always brought the food out on time to feed you. And when we had food, you had no problem.
Were you short of food sometimes?
Yes, when the Japs struck at 2 and the Aleutian Isle, the Kodiak Isle, then food ran out for the men. So we got isolated. When we got isolated, we had to begin eating. They dropped canned food in called K-rations. That was canned meat, canned cookies, hard candy.
Did they actually drop it from the sky?
They dropped it from the sky. Okay. And they would radio and tell you where to pick up your mail and your food.
What's the longest you can remember going without a mail delivery?
I didn't go without a meal, because I was in the medicals. I had a lot of foods in my tent. I had a lot of canned milk under my bed that was frozen. I had the cookies who were, they were from my Louisiana, and all Louisiana guys seemed to have looked out for each other in each kitchen.
What about mail? The mail letters from home, what's the longest
mail,
you
know about? It was harder to get mail. It would get to the POE in Seattle, and it was just late getting to us because of the Japs being in Attu. But we did get mail.
Anything I forgot to ask that I should have?
No, I don't think there's anything that you forgot to ask, but I would like to add, it was a great experience. It was a great education for me to be in the Army. It just took the U.S. Longer than it took the children of Israel, Moses, to lead the children out of Israel to give us some recognition. It took them 40 years getting out of the wilderness, and it took the United States 50 years to say, hey, let's recognize the people who did the Alkane Highway.
Thank you very much, sir.
Contribution to the defense of this nation. But unfortunately, we best laid plans on mice and men. I keep saying it all sometimes goes astray. And this time we got everything together, but the speaker doesn't have the cord so you could hear. So I hate to look at a movie just in black and white and no voice on it. But this is like our last session, and we want you, when you finish talking, we want you to come around this table, those who are still here, maybe just chat a few minutes and let Dr. Barry Smith record you. But the history, since we don't have it, I'm going to improvise this and talk to you briefly. The history of African Americans involved in the defense of nations and the military goes way back into history, quite a long distance back. The greatest warrior that Julius Caesar faced when he was trying to conquer the world was a man named Jugurtha from Numidia, which is an African nation. A difficult man to conquer was Jugurtha, J-U-R-T-H-A, who was quite unwarned. In fact, when he finally conquered Jugurtha, it was such an impressive conquest that they brought him back in a cage, raided this African all through the Roman Empire to show that Caesar had conquered his greatest enemy. So we have been involved in war for many, many years. And then, as you probably know, there's a great writer called Alexandre Dumas, who was a French writer who wrote The Count of Monte Cristo, Three Musketeers, and etc. He's probably the greatest French writer of all time. He was an African Frenchman, not African American, of course, but in European history, he was an African. But his father, let's make shock, his father was the commander of the French forces over Napoleon. He was the full commander of the French army. So when you think of the French Revolution, there's a man that we don't often talk about. His name was Alexandre Dumas I, commander of the French army, and also one of the great conquerors in Russian history was Peter the Great, African friend that we talk about a great deal, and he referred to him as Hannibal. There's another Hannibal also. The great Hannibal from a place called Cartridge, who was an African, who made the Roman general say, Cartridge must be destroyed, because Hannibal and his father Hamilcar, who were both Africans, and these were black Africans, believe it or not, who were able to come and threaten the very existence of the great Roman Empire and almost destroyed Rome. Of course, finally, the Romans won out, but that was a long, long conflict. And the discovery of America, believe it or not, was partly came by because there were a group of black military people called the Moors, who were threatening the safety of Europe for many, many years. And the Spanish people, it was not a Spain, it was a place called Aragon and Castile. You know, the Queen Isabella married the king, King Ferdinand, and they came together and they created modern Spain. And they were so happy to create modern Spain that they were able to finance Columbus' exposition to the New World, or actually to find the East by sailing west, because they found America accidentally, as you probably already know. But it was not until after the Battle of Tours, when they defeated the Moors, that these people could concentrate on looking for the Eastern luxuries. Now, we know that in American history, there were many famous African Americans. There's one black Indian, believe it or not, who was out of Alabama, named Tuscaloosa, here in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. Check your records, you'll find that he was not just an Indian, he was a black Indian. He's called a black warrior. He was so famous that they named the river in Alabama is called the Black Warrior River. And that was no longer in the paper, no longer than a couple of weeks ago, coming out of Alabama itself. It was a black Indian, not a man brown, but a black Indian, who led this conquest against the Spanish conquistadors, or conquistadors. Then we know the American Revolutionary War. That in the American Revolutionary War, black troops fought on both sides, because the English promised black people their freedom if they fought on our side. And then after the English made this promise, then the American colonists had to get some blacks on our side also. So it was called the Ethiopian Brigade, which means black people back in those days. And they were used to fight on both sides. And there were some free blacks that they had in this country, 50,000 free blacks when the Civil War started, but they were free. Some of them got their freedom having fought the Revolutionary War. We were involved in that. Then there was a place called the Battle of Breeze Hill. You call it Bunker Hill. That's the wrong name for it. Bunker Hill is not the real place. The battle took place at a hill close by called Breeze Hill. And the man who killed the commander of the Redcoats was no more than an African-American who was actually shot the commander dead. When Washington crossed the Delaware, there is a known fact. One of the men with him on that boat, or those four men, were an African-American. And you see this little boy that people use, you call the Jocko in people's lawns, you see, you call him the Jocko. Well, supposedly, his real name is Jocko Graves. But that was a little boy who was supposed to have held the horses for Washington when they crossed the Delaware on the other side. This was Washington's personal slave, very handsome little boy. And the boy froze to death holding those horses. So therefore, in honor of this boy who had froze to death, Washington had this boy's statue immortalized holding a horse, like a little holder there. If you see it in the Black Archive, you saw that handsome young boy there. Then, as black people began to become famous jockeys, the first winner of the Kentucky Derby was an African American. I got his picture and his official records in the Black Archive. He was not white, he was black. And the greatest jockeys in the early history of this country were all African Americans. One man won four races in one day. So what happened is, as racism spread, a lot of people started to make little black boys looking very grotesque. See them on people's lawn. And they called it the jockey statue. So that came from a historical phenomena of Washington slave boy. And then we had the War of 1812. Now, Andrew Jackson fought the War of 1812 when he defeated the British in the Battle of New Orleans. Most of the troops, that many of those troops that had took place in this famous battle, were not just white Americans, they also were Indians and they were African Americans. And the man who killed the commander of the Redcoats at the War of 1812 at the Battle of New Orleans was an African American. That's exactly what is enlisted in the journals or the official papers of Andrew Jackson. And he was killed by a black man. He didn't refer to him as Negroes, of course. All right, then we come on up to the Civil War. And as you know, black people fought on both sides of the Civil War, both for the Union forces and for the Confederate forces. Most people don't realize that there were some blacks who fought to defend slavery. Some of them carried guns. Now, not a lot of them, because of course the very fact that they were slaves, people didn't quite trust them. But all military battles, not in what, carrying a gun, some of it right, is building what? Building the Alton Highway. You don't have to be shooting to win the war, right? You got to also construct forts, hasty entrenchments, what have you. So many of the slaves were used to do those kind of things for the Confederate side. And for a long time, the Union force refused to use black troops. In fact, when they finally started to use them, there were all kind of riots. One took place in New York. But Massachusetts had its own black regiment of volunteers. You saw it on TV I think it was last year. And other groups, one was from North Carolina. And other groups were able to volunteer, but mostly from the northern places. And they offered their service to the Union forces, and of course they used it. One of the most famous ladies in the Civil War was Harriet Tubman, who received a special medal from Abraham Lincoln because she was able to work behind the lines, being a slave. She was able to go behind the lines and inform the Union forces of the movement of the Confederate forces. And she got what she called the G.A.R. medal. I had the medal in the archives that belonged to her personally. It's called the Grand Army of the Republic medal for being a hero in the Civil War. So we were involved in Civil War to a great deal. In fact, the black people, well, the troops who defended Petersburg were primarily black troops, as you already knew, I'm sure. And those who were killed at Fort Wagner were African Americans. Of course, they paid a greater price because if the Southern forces caught black troops, they'd just wipe them out. The rules of war did not apply to black people during the Civil War because we were less than human, so therefore we were normally killed off by the Southern forces. But we took a great deal in that. Then in the Spanish-American War, when they sunk the Maine, remember the battleship Maine, there were also black sailors on the Spanish-American War. And of course there were black troops, they were called Smoke Yankees because they fought so well during the Spanish-American War. And they fought in Cuba and other places where they fought. And as you know, there was a man called Theodore Roosevelt who will someday become president. He'd been the Undersecretary of the Navy and other things in his lifetime. And he decided to get his own private army called the Rough Riders. And they left for a place called Tampa, Florida, went to Cuba to defeat the Spanish forces in Cuba. And then he decided they were going to storm up a place called San Juan Hill, which is Rough Riders. And they got up the hill, then they got under heavy fire. And it was the 24th and 25th Cavalry who came to their rescue and got them off that hill. And I told you yesterday, I think, that they were so happy that became the rescue through the Roosevelt, that Roosevelt said that we could share the same canteen. Later on, as you know, there was the 10th Cavalry. Now, if you think about the West and cowboys, but my dear friends, there were many, many black cowboys. There were also many, many scouts that served with the cavalry. There were many black troops in the cavalry. They were called the Buffalo Soldiers. And they were called Buffalo Soldiers because they fought so well. That's the name the Indians gave to them, because you know we got hair like I used to have many years ago. That was used to call, called it napka hair. I don't know why we called it that, but that's what we called it anyway. And that's you see the buffalo got a little wooded spot right here. So the Indians referred to us as being buffalo soldiers because our hair was some of that the buffalo used. And then these soldiers went out there, the Seminole scouts, they were blacks and Indians because they were mixed. They like Mr. Powell. You can see he's part Indian. I know that already. You're looking at it. But the blacks and the Indians out of this territory intermarried, and they were black Seminole scouts, went to the West to conquer the West and to blaze the trail to Texas. And there's a big marker in Texas about these Seminole Scouts who live off of snakes and toads and rats and what have you, and they never lost a single man. Didn't lose a single man. And blazing the trail to the West. Now, we don't see that in the movies, but you can believe me, the conquest of the West was led by these Seminole African-American scouts. Then they fought, as you probably know, in World War I. We were so good, we were called the Hellfighters. We were called the Hellfighters, went to France in the expedition forces led by a man called General Pershing, that you already know, I'm sure you're aware of these. And we won more crosses of honor, of crosses of war from the French than any group in this country. There's one man called Henry Johnson, who was so good, it's known as the private war of captors of Corporal Henry Johnson. He was a one-man fighter. We know about Sergeant York, but we don't know anything about Henry Johnson because we don't talk about that too much. But this was a tremendous war. We played a major role in it. At the very same time, tales were spread that the black men had tails. See, what happened was that the black men and the French women got together, and there was a problem for America, who at that time didn't want to see interracial mixing. So what they did, they spread a tale that Africans were like monkeys. And they had tails. And that backfired because all the French girls were asked, what? Let me see your tail. And they had that too. So this all historical truth. Now, this is strictly historical records. So we were involved in World War I as the Hellfighters. We played a major role in every war. But as you know, as time went on, we got to be more involved than ever. Then we had December 7, 1941, Pearl Harbor there, and I was then 11 years old. I remember that very, very well. And of course, we went into that war. That's where you came in and played your role. I never had any idea in all my historical studies. I've been in history, my friends, all of my life. And I've done a lot of things in history that just come naturally. But I never knew until Dr. Morgan contacted me that there were anybody black anywhere near Alaska. All I knew about Alaska was Eskimo, snow, ice, and the Bering Strait. Now, I did a lot of history. My second area was Russian history. I've done a lot of Russian history. I never knew that there were anything Russia received that we have to do anything about building a road to get supplies to them. So I want to thank you, all of you, every last one of you, from teaching me some history that I won't look at and put it together. And when you see it again, you wouldn't even recognize it. But I want to thank you, all of you. I never knew that in the United States Army in World War II, that you didn't have any black officers. I had a brother in that, spent 30 years and been in service. I did not know that there were actually good, kind, white officers who were looking for their men and whose whole life depending on how well these men perform, because you can't get promoted, you cannot move unless your forces support you, and you certainly can't survive, right, unless somebody over you have enough sense, right, to protect you. So this is a good interracial conference on the history of African Americans and their contributions to the defense of this nation. And I'm glad you were here. I certainly appreciate it, and I'm going to find some way, and you can believe this, because when I said it's going to be done, to get you back here about 2 or 3 years. Just as soon as Dr. Maul get her thing together and get her show on the road, it's going to end up here in Tallahassee. I want you to stay in good shape and to come back. So when you get back here again, I'm going to have me a tennis tournament.
Amen.
I'm bringing that Phil Gibson back. I want to see my tennis star in the back jump over that net. Thank you very much.
Amen.
Appreciate it. Now, what I think that Dr. Cook wants to do, Dr. Bass, would you please stand up? She's one of my good supporters, and that's what the friend would do for you. And I think she's going to want to get some of y'all around the table to let you just sort of talk. You know, sometimes in oral history, one of the things I find that one-on-one is fine, but once in a while, this group talking, you know, and just discussion tend to get you some historical ideas with Donna have, because you can correct each other because you're already there. Dr. Spitz, you want to say a few words?
As you know, we are, in addition to celebrating, we're gathering research. We're doing research so that we can have it both in Alaska and in the Black Archives. So that what we thought we would do at the end is give you all an opportunity to, in fact, exchange stories, war stories, and those kinds of things. We would like to take them, and it's hoped that by having you all talk, first of all, it's a chance for you all to get together and just kind of talk. But in addition to that, maybe we will be able to get more people's names and more stories and so on, because this is just the beginning of what we expect to be. We, and I'm talking about Leon and Cal and Mr. Eton and Titus and myself, what we expect to be a long and in-depth research activity. So what we'd like to ask you to do, all of us, we have spoken to you individually, and Odell has been talking to some, and Dow and I have been talking to some, and Mr. Eton as well. What we'd like to ask, just for a few minutes, until you have to leave, or if you get tired of the board or whatever, if you all would come up, and what I think would be best is if we could put the chairs on both sides of the table, so that rather than spreading out, we're all close together. And you just put our paper corners on, and you all can talk about anything you want to. We'll probably ask you questions, right? We'll be asking you some questions about some of the things perhaps we've talked about, or that you haven't talked about that we had questions about. But it's basically a loose thing. If you all don't mind, would you all mind doing that for us?
Could I ask one thing, Valerie? That I had hoped to get individual interviews with everybody here for the archives, and as you know, it was such a busy day yesterday. We were supposed to be doing this yesterday, it didn't happen, and this was the time that I was supposed to be getting your individual interviews. And some of you are leaving within the hour. If I can't get to you, I'm going to suggest that maybe you take the paperwork, my card, and address, and maybe make me a tape on your own, which would be useful. If I get to your section of the country, I will surely look you up and try to do something individual. How many people here are leaving before noontime? Good, well, maybe I will have a chance. So, well, I don't want to do that because I think that if people will stay and get, I think that this discussion will be very, very valuable because we can talk to you enough so that you're right, people are going to remember things that you might not individually. So, but try and see me before you leave, and maybe we can make some arrangements.
Yeah, and make it
where,
on both sides
of it,
right here.
Also, those of you who haven't filled out forms, would do so for our archive.
They'll have to talk loud enough where they'll also be on the floor.
Okay. Yes, please. I think each one that's Darren, you can do that.
This way we can put the recorder right in the middle.
Now, one person needs to register. That's you, right?
Right.
No, he didn't register. If you want to register, you don't want to. If you do see my wife, just give your name.